Chapter 6 Recognition. At these words, and at sight of the speaker, Morton Harlan started back as if he'd been shot.
"Santorus!" he exclaimed. "It is impossible. Rafael Santorus? Oh, no, you must be his son."
The newcomer laughed. "Good old Harlan, always the skeptic. Miracles are common enough, but one miracle is beyond all possibility. A man cannot be his own offspring. I am indeed that very Santorus, whom you saw last at Oxford. Come, come, which of us has changed, really?" Stepping more fully into the light that came from the open door of the saloon, he showed himself a man of distinguished appearance, about, one would have guessed, 40 years of age. He was well-formed, with the straight back and broad shoulders of an athlete. His face was finely featured, and he radiated health and strength. Smiling, he laid one hand on Mr. Harlan's shoulder, looking the very embodiment of powerful manhood. Morton Harlan stared at him in amazement and with something of terror.
"Rafael Santorus?" he repeated. "You are indeed his living image, but you cannot be he. You are too young."
A gleam of amusement sparkled in the stranger's eyes. "Don't let's talk of youth or age for the moment," he said. "Here I am, your eccentric college acquaintance, whom you and a few other fellows shied away from years ago. I assure you, however, I am quite harmless. Will you present me to the ladies?" There was a brief pause of embarrassment. Then Mr. Harlan turned to us where we stood, withdrawn a little apart, and addressed his daughter.
"Catherine," he said, "this gentleman tells me we knew each other at Oxford. Do you remember? I spoke of him at dinner only the other night, but I did not mention his name. The name is Rafael Santorus, if indeed this is Santorus. The Santorus I spoke of, however, should be a much older man."
"I regret my failure," said our visitor, bowing courteously to the two of us, "to fulfill the required conditions of age. Will you both try to forgive me?" He smiled a little impishly. We both were struck dumb. Involuntarily, I raised my gaze to his, and with that glance beheld in those clear blue orbs, so steadfastly meeting mine, a world of memories. Memories tender, wistful, and pathetic, shrouded as it were in tears and in fire. All my instincts told me that I knew him well as one knows the golden warmth of the sunshine, or the blue color of the sky. Yet where had I seen him before? It had been often and often. Of this I was certain. While my thoughts puzzled over this question, he averted his gaze from mine and addressed Catherine. "I understand," he said, "that you are interested in the lighting of my yacht."
"It is most beautiful and wonderful," replied Catherine in tones of conventional politeness. "And so unusual."
His eyebrows rose in a slightly quizzical expression. "Yes, I suppose to you it seems unusual," he said. "I keep forgetting that what is not common may seem to many people uncanny. But really, the matter is quite simple. My yacht is called the Dream, and she is, as the name implies, a dream fulfilled. Her sails are her only motive power. They are charged with electricity drawn from the ocean water, which explains also why they shine so at night. If you will honor me with a visit tomorrow, I will gladly show you how it works." At this point, Captain Derrick, who had been standing with us, was unable to resist pursuing the matter.
"Excuse me, sir," he said suddenly. "May I ask you how you managed to sail without wind?"
"Certainly," Santorus replied. "The Bible tells us, ask and you shall receive. As I have just said, our sails are our only motive power, but we don't need wind to fill them. By a very simple scientific method, or rather, let's say, by a scientific application of natural means, we generate a form of electric force from the water as we move. This force fills the sails and propels us with amazing swiftness wherever we go. Neither calm nor storm affects her progress. When a good wind blows our way, we naturally take advantage of it. But we can make excellent speed, even in the teeth of a gale. Thus we free ourselves from the inconveniences of your kind of yacht, with its steam, smoke, dirt, and noise. I dare say in another 200 years or so, this method of sailing the seas will be applied to all ships, large and small, and everyone will wonder why this method was not thought of ages ago.
Why not make use of this discovery yourself?
Inquired Dr. Braille, at this point joining the conversation. He put his question with a slightly jeering air of incredulity.
With such a marvelous discovery, if it is yours, you could make your fortune.
Santoris looked at him with a quiet smile. Perhaps I do not need to make my fortune, he said. He then turned back to Captain Derrick and said kindly, I hope the matter seems clearer to you now. We sail without wind, it is true, but not without some of the power that creates wind. The captain shook his head perplexedly.
Well, sir, I confess I can't quite take it in. I'd like to know more.
So you shall. Harlan, will all of you come over to my yacht tomorrow? We might take an excursion together, and you may care to remain and dine with me afterwards. Please consider this a friendly invitation, for we are indeed old friends, though you find the idea difficult to accept. Mr. Harlan's face was a study in perplexity, as doubt and fear struggled together for mastery. He did not answer at once. Then, conquering his hesitation, he recovered himself.
Give me a moment with you alone,
he said with a gesture of invitation toward the deck saloon. Our visitor readily complied with his suggestion. The two men entered the saloon together, closing the door behind them. Silence followed. Catherine looked at me questioningly. Then she called to Mr. Swinton, who had been standing about with his usual air of obedience, as though awaiting orders.
What sort of interview did you have with that gentleman when you got on board his yacht?
She asked him.
Very pleasant indeed, Swinton replied. The vessel is magnificently appointed. I've never observed such luxury. It was extraordinary, more than princely. Mr. Santoris himself I found particularly agreeable. When he had read Mr. Harlan's note, he said he was glad to find it was from an old college acquaintance, and would come over with me to renew it, as he has done.
You're not in any way afraid of him?
Asked Dr. Braille sarcastically.
Oh, dear, no. He seems quite well-bred, and I should say he must be very wealthy.
A most powerful recommendation, murmured the doctor absently. What do you think of him? He asked, turning suddenly to me.
I offer no opinion, I replied quietly. What else could I say? How could I tell such a man as this, of one who had entered my life so insistently, suddenly illumining all that had hitherto been darkness? At that moment, Catherine caught my hand. Listen, she whispered. A window of the deck saloon was open near where we stood. Dr. Braille and Mr. Swinton had moved away to light fresh cigars. We two were, for the moment, alone. We heard Mr. Harlan's voice raised in a sort of smothered cry.
My God, you are Santoris!
Of course I am. And the deep, musical tones were grave with tender compassion. Yes, it was natural to doubt it. But why do you call upon God? That name has no meaning for you. There followed a silence. I looked at Catherine and saw her pale face, haggard in the light of the moon, and old for her years. My heart filled with pity for her. She was excited beyond the usual. I could see that the appearance of this stranger had aroused her interest and compelled her admiration. Yet she was also trembling with fear. I tried to draw her gently away from the saloon, but she wouldn't move.
We ought not to listen, I said. Catherine, come away.
She shook her head.
Hush!
She only breathed the word.
I want to hear.
Just then Mr. Harlan spoke again.
I am sorry, he said. I have wronged you, and I apologize. But you can hardly wonder at my disbelief, considering your appearance. Why, you look like a man much younger than your years.
the rich voice of Santorus replied. Did I not tell you and the others long ago that for me time does not exist? There is only eternity. The soul is not the body, and the soul is always young. I live in the spirit of youth, not in the decay of age. Catherine turned her eyes upon me, wide open in amazement.
He must be mad, she whispered.
I made no reply, either by word or look. We heard Mr. Harlan talking in a lower tone and were unable to distinguish what he said. Presently, Santorus answered, his tones vibrant and distinct. Why should it seem to you so wonderful? He said. You do not think it miraculous when the sculptor, standing before a shapeless block of marble, uses it to conform with his inward thoughts? The marble is mere marble, difficult to shape. Yet out of its resisting solidity, the sculptor can mold an Apollo or a Psyche. You find nothing marvelous in this, though the result of the shaping is due only to thought and labor. The human body is far easier than marble to shape, yet when you see it brought into submission by the same forces, thought and labor, you are astonished. Surely it is easier to control the living cells of one's own body by the dominating power of the soul than to chisel the semblance of a god out of a block of stone? There followed a pause. Mr. Harlan spoke a few more words. Then, while we waited expectantly for further fragments of conversation, the saloon door was suddenly thrown open and Mr. Harlan called us to come in. We at once obeyed his summons, and as we entered eagerly, he announced excitedly,
I must apologize before you ladies for the doubting manner in which I received my former college friend. He is Raphael Santorus. I have always known there could be only one of his type, but I had no idea. Why, he should be nearly as old as I am, and look at him.
I laughed. It would have been hard not to. The mere idea of comparing these two men was absurd. Santorus was in such splendid prime, whereas Morton Harlan, in his lean, crumpling condition, seemed almost at his last gasp. The mere thought of them as being of roughly the same age seemed ludicrous. Even Catherine smiled, weakly and timidly.
You have aged more quickly, Father, she said. Perhaps Mr. Santorus has not lived under such high pressure.
Santorus, standing by the center table under the full blaze of the electric lamp overhead, gave her a kindly look. High or low, I live each moment of every day to the full, Miss Harlan, he said. I do not drowse it or kill it. I live it. This lady, he turned his eyes toward me, looks as if she did the same.
She does indeed, said Mr. Harlan quickly and with emphasis. That's entirely true. You are always a good reader of character, Santorus. I believe I have not introduced you to properly.
Here he presented me by name, and I held out my hand. Santorus took it in his own with a light, warm clasp, then gently released it and bowed. Mr. Harlan went on.
I call her our little friend because she carries an atmosphere of joy around her. We persuaded her to come yachting with us this summer for what I confess was a very selfish reason. We are disposed to be dull, and I saw her always bright. The advantage, you see, has been all on our side.
He paused a moment. He looked out the dark window, then continued.
Oddly enough, I was talking to her about you only the other night. The very night, as it happens, that your yacht came behind us off Mull. That was rather a curious coincidence, don't you think?
Not curious at all, said Santorus. It was perfectly natural. Coincidence is a greatly overused word. What we see in life is the working of a very exact law. Mr. Harlan gave a slight gesture of incredulity.
Your theories again, he said. You hold them still, I see. But our little friend here is likely to agree with you, so I'd better not say too much. When I was speaking to her of you, I told her that the two of you held somewhat the same ideas. She is sort of a psychist, whatever that means.
Don't you know?
Queried Santoris with a grave smile.
The difference between you is easy to guess by merely glancing at her.
My cheeks grew warm, and my eyes fell beneath his steadfast gaze. I wondered whether Mr. Harlan or Catherine would notice that in his coat he wore a small bunch of the same kind of bright pink bell heather, which was my only jewel of adorning that night. The ice of introductory recognition being broken, we gathered round the saloon table and sat down, while the steward brought wine and other refreshments to offer to our guest. Mr. Harlan's former uneasiness and embarrassment seemed melted away, and he gave himself up to the pleasure of renewing the association he'd known with a fellow student. They spoke together easily of their days at the university and of the men they had known there, some of whom were now dead, some settled abroad, and some lost to sight in the dim vistas of an uncertain fate. Catherine took very little part in the conversation, but she listened intently. Her colorless eyes were, for once, bright, and she watched the face of Santoris as one might watch an animated picture. Presently, Dr. Braille and Mr. Swinton, who had been pacing the deck together, paused near the saloon door. Mr. Harlan beckoned them in.
"Come in, come in," he said. "Santoris, this is my physician, Dr. Braille, who has undertaken to look after me during this cruise."
Santoris bowed.
"And this is my secretary, Mr. Swinton, whom I sent over to your yacht just now."
Again, Santoris bowed. His slight yet perfectly courteous salutation was in marked contrast to the careless modern nod or jerk of the head by which the other men barely acknowledged their introduction to him.
"Mr. Swinton was afraid for his life to go to you," continued Mr. Harlan, laughing. "He thought you might be an illusion, or even with those fiery sails, the devil himself."
Mr. Swinton looked sheepish, but Santoris smiled.
"This fair dreamer of dreams,"
continued Mr. Harlan, singling me out for notice,
"is the only one of us who has expressed neither surprise nor fear at the sight of your vessel, or at the possibility of acquaintance with yourself. Still, there was one little incident connected with the pretty bunch of bell heather she is wearing."
He stopped suddenly.
"Why, I see you wearing the same flower yourself."
There ensued a moment's silence while everyone stared. The blood burned in my veins, and I felt my face growing crimson. Yet I knew no reason why I should be embarrassed or at a loss for words. Santoris came to my relief.
"There's nothing remarkable in that, is there?" he inquired lightly. "Bell heather is quite common in this part of the world. I shouldn't like to try and count the number of tourists I've seen lately wearing it."
"Ah, but you don't understand the interest attached to this particular specimen," persisted Mr. Harlan. "It was given to our little friend by a wild Highland fellow, presumably a Mull native, the very morning after we had seen your yacht for the first time. He told her that on the previous night he had brought all of the same kind he could gather to you. Surely you see the connection?"
Santoris shook his head.
"I'm afraid I don't," he said smilingly. "Did the wild Highland fellow name me?"
"No, he only called you the gentleman that owns the yacht."
"Oh, well," and Santoris laughed, "there are so many gentlemen that own yachts. He may have got me mixed with his other customers. In any case, I am glad to have even this little thing in common with our friend."
"There is something very curious about her bunch, anyway,"
put in Catherine.
"It never fades."
Santoris made no comment. Perhaps he had not heard, or did not wish to hear. Much to my comfort, he changed the conversation, and for the rest of the time he was with us, he rather avoided speaking to me, though once or twice I met his eyes fixed on me earnestly. The talk now drifted to various ordinary topics, and I, moving aside a little, took a seat near the window, where I could watch the moon rays striking the still waters of Loch Scavaig, while still listening to all that was said. I did not wish to speak, for the uplifted joy of my soul was too intense for anything but silence. I didn't know why I was so happy, or I couldn't have said. I only knew by some inner instinct that a point in my life had been reached, towards which I had striven for much longer than I myself was aware. There was nothing for me now but to wait for the next step with faith and patience, a step which I felt I would not take alone. And I listened with interest while Mr. Harlan put his former college friend through a kind of catechism as to what he had been doing and where he had journeyed since they last met. Santoris seemed perfectly willing to be catechized.
"When I escaped from Oxford," began, but here Mr. Harlan interposed.
"Escaped?" he exclaimed. "You talk as if you had been incarcerated in a prison."
"So I was, in a sense," Santoris replied. "Oxford is a prison to all who want to feed on something more than the dry bones of other people's learning. While there, I was a prodigal son, exiled from my father's house, and I also ate the husk that the swine did eat. Many fellows have to do the same. Sometimes, though, not often, a man arrives with a constitution that is unsuited to husk. Mine has always been such."
"Yet you secured honors with those husks,"
said Mr. Harlan. Santoris gave a gesture of displeasure.
"Honors? Such honors? Any fellow not addicted to drinking and with a fair amount of determined plod could win them. The alleged difficulties in the way are perfectly infantile. They scarcely deserve to be called the pothooks and hangers of an education. I always got my work done in 2 or 3 hours. The rest of my time at college was pure leisure, which I employed, as you know, in other forms of study than those offered by the general curriculum."
"You mean occult mysteries and things of that sort?"
"Occult is a word of such new coinage that it doesn't exist in many dictionaries," said Santoris with a mirthful look. "You will not find it, for instance, in the earlier editions of many reliable compendiums. I do not care for it myself. I prefer to say spiritual science."
"You believe in that?"
said Catherine abruptly.
"Assuredly. How can anyone do otherwise, once one sees that this science is the key to the very soul of nature?"
"This is just too deep for me,"
said Dr. Brayle dismissively, pouring himself out a glass of whiskey and mixing it with soda water.
"If it's a riddle, I give it up."
Santoris was silent. There ensued a momentary pause. Then Catherine leaned forward across the table, looked at him with tired eyes, and asked,
"Could you please explain?"
"Easily," he answered. "Anyone who gives the subject even a little thought will understand it. My meaning is this. You must realize that, outwardly, the human body expresses its inner condition. It is the result of that condition. Health of body, mind, and spirit depend above all on one's inner attitude. Spiritual science is the knowledge of the inner cause, which makes the effect manifest. This knowledge can be applied to everything in life. The more we develop this consciousness inwardly, the more rewarding it becomes, leading to ever greater discoveries, some of which are simple, some of which complex. But the nearer one comes to the consciousness of his indwelling soul, the more he is able to master his outward body as well, and to remain in a state of glowing good health and harmony."
"You are satisfied with your researches, then?"
asked Mr. Harlan. Santoris smiled gravely.
"Do I look like someone who is disappointed?"
Mr. Harlan studied his handsome face with ill-concealed envy.
"After Oxford, you went abroad?"
he asked. "Yes, I went back to my old home in Egypt, to the house where I was born and bred. It had been well kept and cared for by one faithful servant to whom my father had entrusted it. It was the best of all possible places in which to continue my particular studies without interruption. I stayed there most of the time, only coming away as at present, when necessary, and for a change and a look at the world as people live in it these days."
"And?"
Here Mr. Harlan hesitated, then went on.
"Are you married?"
Santoris lifted his eyes and regarded his former college acquaintance fixedly. Surely that question is unnecessary, he replied. You must know that I am not.
There was a brief, awkward pause. Then Dr. Braille looked at him with a satirical smile.
No doubt your spiritual science has taught you to be wary of the fair sex, he said.
I do not completely understand you, Santoris answered coolly. If, however, you mean that I am not a lover of women in the plural, you are right.
Perhaps the one woman, the one rare pearl in the deep sea, hinted Dr. Braille, unembarrassed.
Come, you are getting altogether too personal, Braille,
interrupted Mr. Harlan quickly and with asperity. Santoris,
your health.
He raised a glass of wine to his lips. Santoris did the same, and this simple courtesy between the two principals in the conversation had the effect of putting their subordinate in his proper place.
It seems superfluous to wish good health to Mr. Santoris, said Catherine. He evidently has it to perfection.
Santoris looked at her with kindly interest. Health is a law, Miss Harlan, he said. It is by our own fault that we lose it, by trespassing against the law.
Ah, you say that because you are well and strong, she answered in a plaintive tone. But if you were afflicted with suffering, you would take a very different view of illness.
Santoris smiled compassionately. I think not, he said. If I were afflicted with suffering, as you say, I should know that I had somehow neglected the law by thoughtlessness, carelessness, or selfishness. People injure themselves constantly, both physically and mentally. But the penalty for such often willful neglect is just and reasonable.
Surely you do not maintain that a man is responsible for his own ailments, said Mr. Harlan. That would be too far-fetched even for you. Why, it is a simple matter of fact that we are not only cursed with the poison in our own blood, but, according to the latest medical science, with the poison blood of our forefathers. Indeed, the very air and water of this planet are polluted with the germs of death, of which we are the unsuspecting victims.
Germs of death? Said Santoris quietly, or germs of life? According to my knowledge of higher truth, theory, as you prefer to call it, there are no germs of actual death. There are only germs that disintegrate effete forms of matter in order to allow the forces of life to rebuild them. The germs in our bodies propagate according to the systems they inhabit, that is, according to what the human system is prepared to receive. Their devastating influence is called disease, but it never begins its damaging work until the system they attack has wasted vital opportunities and neglected vital necessities. Far more numerous are the beneficial germs of revivifying and creative power. If these can get a foothold, they are bound to conquer those agents whose influence is destructive. It all depends on the fertility of the soil you offer them. Evil thoughts create evil blood. In evil blood, disease flourishes. Pure thoughts create pure blood and revitalize the cells of health and energy. There is, I grant you, such a thing as inherited disease. But even this could be prevented in great measure by making marriage between such diseased persons a legal offense. Yes, a difficult project, I grant you. But still, much of such inherited disease could be driven out by proper care during childhood.
What would you call proper care?
Asked Catherine. To begin with, complete abstinence from self-indulgence, he replied. No child should have its whims be indulged too freely. The first great lesson of life should be renunciation of self. A faint color crept into Catherine's faded cheeks. Mr. Harland fidgeted in his chair.
Unless a man takes care of himself, he said, no one else will take care of him.
Reasonable care for oneself is unselfish, replied Santoris. Anything in excess of reasonable care, however, is sheer vice. A man should work for his livelihood rather than let himself become a burden on others.
Beyond that point, however, he should work for the good of all, and not only for his own good. To be ill is the result of some broken law. If the crime, as we may call it, was committed, it was in the past, and he can only take his punishment and do his best to expiate it. But he can at least acknowledge his need from now on to live by the law.
You are laying down a very hard and fast rule, Mr. Santoris, objected Dr. Braille. Many unfortunate people are ill through no fault of their own.
Pardon me, but such a thing is impossible, answered Santoris. If a human being meets ill health, the fault cannot be other than his own. You overlook the possibility, which to me is a certainty, that we have lived many lives before. The reason for the vast variety we see in human beings is that, on their long, long road to perfection, they have shaped themselves. The trespasses they have committed against the law, as well as the times when they have fulfilled it, have made them what they are today. It shows in their very aura, the light they emanate around them. Suppose a baby is born with a congenital defect. As he grows, he can work resolutely to rise above it, but he cannot ignore it, and he cannot wish it away. Yes, he can eliminate harmful influences from his blood, if you choose to call it that, and if he so determines, but he can never do so with a supine attitude. Man was not meant to be sickly, but strong. He was not intended to dwell here on earth as a slave, but as a master. All the elements of individual sovereignty are there for him to use and take advantage of, if he will only accept them as honestly and bravely as they are offered ungrudgingly. I cannot grant you, and here he smiled, even the smallest amount of voluntary or intended mischief in the divine plan. At that moment, Captain Derrick looked in at the saloon door to remind us that the boat still waited to take our visitor back to his yacht. Santoris rose at once with a brief apology for having stayed so long, and we all went on deck to see him off. It was settled that we would join him on board his yacht next day and either take a sail with him along the island coast or do the excursion on foot with him to Loch Korusk. This excursion was not to be missed. As we walked together on the moonlit deck, a chance moment placed him by my side as the others moved on ahead. I felt rather than saw his eyes upon me, and looked up swiftly in obedience to his compelling glance. There was a light of eloquent meaning in the expression of his face, but he spoke in perfectly conventional tones. "I am glad to have met you at last," he said quietly. "I have known you in the spirit and by name for a long time." I did not answer. My heart was beating rapidly with a combination of excitement, joy, and even a certain dread of some happiness almost overwhelming. "Tomorrow," he continued, "we shall be able to walk together, I hope. I feel there are many things in which we have a mutual interest." Still, I could not speak. "Sometimes it happens," he continued, speaking with a slight tremble, "that two people who are not immediately conscious of having met before feel on their first introduction that they are quite old friends. Is that not so?" I murmured a scarcely audible assent. He bent his head and looked at me searchingly, a smile on his lips. His eyes were full of tenderness. "Till tomorrow is not a long time to wait," he said. "Not long, after so many years. Good night." A sense of calm and sweet assurance swept over me. "Good night," I answered, with a smile of happy response to his own. "Till tomorrow." We were close to the gangway where the others already stood. In another moment, he had made his adieu to the whole party and was on his way to his own vessel. The dinghy in which he sat, rowed strongly by his own men, soon disappeared in the general darkness, yet we remained for some time watching, as though he could be seen long after he'd become invisible.
"A strange fellow,"
said Dr. Braille, flinging the end of his cigar over the yacht side as we moved away at last.
Something of the madman and the genius combined.
Mr. Harlan turned quickly upon him.
You mistake, he said sharply. There is no madness there, though there certainly is genius. He's of the same mind as he was when I knew him at Oxford. There never was a saner or more brilliant man.
It's curious you should meet him again like this, Father, said Catherine. But surely he's not so old as you are.
He's only 3 years younger, that's all.
Dr. Braille laughed.
I don't believe it for a moment, he said. I think he's playing a part. He's probably not the man you knew at Oxford at all.
We were then going to our cabins for the night, and Mr. Harlan paused as these words were said and faced us.
He is the man, he insisted emphatically. I had my doubts of him at first, but I was wrong. As for playing a part, that would be impossible to him. He is absolutely truthful, almost to the verge of cruelty.
A curious expression came into his eyes, as of hidden fear.
In one way, I am glad to have met him again. In another, I am sorry, for he is a disturber of the comfortable peace of conventions. You,
here he regarded me suddenly, as if he had almost forgotten my presence.
You will like him. You have many ideas in common, and we'll be sure to get on well together. As for me, I am his direct opposite. The two poles are not wider apart than we are in our feelings, sentiments, and beliefs.
He paused, seeming to be troubled by the passing cloud of some painful thought. Then he went on.
There is one thing I should perhaps explain, especially to you, Braille, to save useless argument. It is, of course, a craze, but craze or not, he is absolutely immovable on one point, which he calls the great fact of life, that there is and can be no death, that life is eternal and therefore, in all its forms, indestructible.
But, Father, interposed Catherine, what was all that stuff he mentioned about our living many lives?
It was the most utter nonsense, declared Dr. Braille. I didn't say anything because he was your guest, but surely you realize he was spinning fairy tales.
I have not studied the subject, answered Mr. Harlan, and neither have you. But he has, and I will not reject offhandedly anything he says without giving the matter careful thought.
And what about death?
Persisted Dr. Braille derisively.
Does he consider himself immune to the common lot of mortals?
He denies the common lot altogether, replied Mr. Harlan. For him, each individual life is a perpetual succession of progressive or regressive changes. He holds that a change of bodies is never and can never be made until the person concerned is ready for a new try or for eternity.
Then he is mad, exclaimed Catherine. He must be mad.
My considered verdict, pronounced Dr. Braille, as if speaking from a judge's bench, is that he is not normal. Were it not for my respect for your regard for him, sir, I would say that he is either insane or a charlatan.
I smiled.
Then I am mad, too, I said, for I believe as he does, and I am not a charlatan. May I say good night? And with that I left them, glad to be alone with myself and with my heart's secret rapture.